So the other day, I had an email exchange with a young journalist, a guy straight out of college, and he wrote something that rubbed me wrongly, and I responded with a letter I wish someone had sent me long ago. So I'm just going to read it, and I hope it helps someone avoid the rocky path I once took. I wrote, "I want to give you advice I wish someone had given me at 22, 23. I really mean that, because when I was young and coming out of college, I was painfully cocky, and I expressed it. But here's the thing, nobody ever likes a cocky college kid. Never, ever, 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 ever. Confident? Sure, if expressed the right way. Competent? Definitely. But what people genuinely want from newbies is humility, doggedness, a willingness to do anything, a little bit of deference, and an eagerness to learn. I'm speaking from experience. I made this career much harder on myself by conveying a certain I'm better than you strut that, in truth, mostly hid insecurity and doubt. But I was genuinely hated at my first job and nearly lost it, just because I came off as a massive dick. I swear to God I'm only trying to help, because I hate people making the mistakes I did. Walk humbly. Don't assume the 48-year-old or the 35-year-old or the 60-year-old wants to exchange barbs and snappy comments with you. Work hard, bust your ass. I wish someone had told me this stuff when I was green." My name is Jeff Perlman. I'm the New York Times bestselling author of 9 books and the host of Two Writers Sling and Yang, the podcast where one writer, me, talks writing with another writer every single week. Today's episode features Joan Ryan, the longtime sports writer, a media consultant for the San Francisco Giants, and the author of the wonderful new book, Intangibles, Unlocking the Science and Soul of Team Chemistry. This is episode number 165. Let's sling some yang.
Dad, being quarantined sucks, and so does your podcast.
All right, Joan, we're under strict orders that we cannot show any visuals from this because we both look like two schlubbubs sitting in our garages. I just got a mohawk shaved in my head. You're wearing a sweatshirt and, you know, where it's late at night here. You had a book come out a couple of weeks ago. I've been asking this a lot lately, but I will ask sort of here. What is it to have a book come out during a pandemic?
Well, it's challenging, obviously, in a lot of ways, because as you know, Jeff, better than anybody, you know, you put so much work, and I'm almost embarrassed to say it. You know, this was 10 years in the making. I did write another book during that, but it was 10 years in the making, and all you can think about is, you know, I just want to give birth. I got to get this baby out of me and put it out in the world. And it's really not for me. It's not until the actual book is out that I feel like I'm finished. Like, I can't make any more changes. I can't interview one more person. And so then, you know, your book launch date comes and it's fairly meaningless. You know, you can't have a party, all of that. Now, having said that, I think there's an advantage to it as well, in that right now, all we can do is, you know, Zoom interviews that get recorded and maybe they go on TV, maybe they go online. We can do radio shows. We can do podcasts. We can't, you know, go into a studio. We can't have live events, you know, no bookstores, no lectures, you know, none of that sort of thing, which is so fun. I mean, I love all of that interaction with readers. But we get, all of us who have books coming out during this pandemic, we get another bite of the apple, because when the bookstores do open and we do have, you know, we can have crowds again, it's almost like a second launch. Mm-hmm. So we can kind of go out and hopefully by that time you have a little traction from what we have been able to do.
You wrote a book I would never want to write, and here's why. I am always really intimidated by the idea. Like, every now and then someone will say, you should do a book about blah, blah, blah. And it's this broad umbrella topic. Like, you should do a book about steroids in baseball. You should do a book about left-handed relievers. And I always think that is just too big for my brain. I can't do 10 years on team chemistry. It's too big. And I wonder, like, writing a book that is a huge umbrella topic like team chemistry, it seems like it would actually drive a person insane trying to corral something that enormous into 250 pages. More manageable or less manageable than you sort of expected it to be?
Way more unmanageable. I mean, I knew I was biting off a lot, but when you first start, and at first I didn't know if I was doing a book, if I was going to do an article, what I was going to do. So I started thinking about this in 2009, when I attended the 20th anniversary of the 89 Giants going to the World Series, winning the pennant, going to the World Series, which was the Earthquake World Series, and they got swept by the A's. But that team was really, really special, that 89 Giants, because they, you know, they were, you know, this junk drawer jumble of a team with factions in there, that very clear factions, and yet it all worked. You know, they fought and they, you know, did all kinds of things, but they really, you could tell, like, they really loved each other. And when I was walking around that tent in 2009, I could hear it in their voices and see it in their faces. They still loved each other. And when I left and I was driving home, you know, and the term team chemistry kept coming up in their conversations. And I, you know, always like thought team chemistry existed. You know, I played sports myself, and even in my, you know, my first newsroom in Orlando, you know, there was something going on in that, actually the sports section, sports department. And so on the way home, I was thinking, well, what is team chemistry? I mean, does it exist? I mean, we're in the middle of analytics, even in 2009. And you think, well, a lot of people don't believe it exists. And so, you know, I kind of was driven for the next 10 years to answer three questions. Does it exist? If it exists, well, what is it exactly? And how does it affect performance? Because if it doesn't affect performance, why even talk about it? And so that's what really got me going on the book. And then the research just became so fascinating, I couldn't let it go. And, you know, here we are 10 years later.
Well, I want to ask you something about the 89 Giants in relation to this. So I wrote a book about the 86 Mets. So I wrote a lot about Kevin Mitchell, who obviously was a star. And I have had several run-ins with one of my least favorite athletes I've ever dealt with, Will Clark, who was the first baseman on those teams. And I always thought you couldn't find two more opposite people than Will Clark and Kevin Mitchell. So does it matter in the world of team chemistry whether Kevin Mitchell and Will Clark get along?
No. No.
Why?
And I ran into this with Barry Bonds and Jeff Kent, right? Years later with the Giants. And it was the same thing. And actually, Will Clark and Kevin Mitchell did get along. It was Will Clark and Jeffrey Leonard that didn't get along.
Yeah, that was a bad one.
At all. Mm-hmm. But to your question, and Bonds and Kent is might be a better example, because I mean it was on television, them, you know, fighting each other in the dugout. Neither one had any regard for the other at all. Yet they had chemistry, and here's why they had chemistry: for the same reason those Oakland A's teams and Yankees teams of the 70s. People always ask, you know, would always ask me, well, you know, how could chemistry matter when, you know, these teams clearly didn't have chemistry and they still won. But what they had was task chemistry, what I came to call task chemistry. On the field, they had amazing chemistry. Because, you know, the foundation of team chemistry is a few things, but one of the main things is trust, right? So the social emotional chemistry in the clubhouse, you know, guys trust each other. They assume good intention. If somebody's telling you something that's kind of critical, okay, he's telling me because, you know, and I trust him. So I trust the message. But there are teams and like those 70s teams and the Barry Bonds, Jeff Kent teams, where Barry Bonds and Jeff Kent completely trusted each other on the field. When I interviewed both of them, and it's actually my favorite chapter of the book, because it surprised me that that's what it was, that Bonds wasn't a cancer, Jeff Kent wasn't a cancer, which I kind of went into this book thinking, well, my super carrier is Johnny Gomes, a super carrier of chemistry, and my super disruptor of chemistry was Barry Bonds, and I found something different. But what I needed to understand was, well, why did it work? And it was because when they were out on the field, you know, Barry Bonds wanted no one else at second base than Jeff Kent. And Jeff Kent didn't want anybody else in left field than Barry Bonds. And they both made each other better. Bonds will never, never, ever acknowledge that. But Jeff Kent did make him better. And certainly Barry Bonds made Jeff Kent much better. The 6 years Kent was there were the six best years of his career.
Let's say Barry Bonds hits 42 home runs and Jeff Kent hits 36 home runs and they both hit 300 and they both make the All-Star team. Who cares if they get along? Who cares if they even like each other or if they trust each other as long as they're doing their jobs? Why does any of this matter at all?
Well, it doesn't matter that they like each other. They don't need to like each other, but they need to trust each other. You have to know that the other guys on the field with you care as much about winning as you do, that are as prepared as you are, that are going to put out 100% effort. They care about their craft. That's a team that has incredibly great task chemistry, right? And it does matter, because if you see somebody else, you know, busting their ass out there, you're more likely to bust yours too, right? And there's also an accountability and a respect that goes on at that elite level. The cancers in the clubhouse, the cancers on a team, are not the Barry Bonds and the Jeff Kents. They're the complainers and the malingerers, you know, the clubhouse lawyers. Those are the guys that eat away at that sense of we're all in this together. And they're looking for recruits. Like, the complainers are always looking for recruits. Those are the guys that are really dangerous. Or the malingerers that, you know, are always asking for their day off when Clayton Kershaw's pitching. That kind of guy. And the rest of the team loses respect for them. And they spend more time complaining about that guy than they are focused on the team. So that can erode. But to your question, no. I mean, talent, and kind of what you're talking about, is that if you have the talent and those guys are doing their job, what else do you need? And team chemistry can't manufacture talent. What it does is it squeezes the absolute most out of the talent that you have. And with the Bonds-Kent thing, yeah, they can go about and do their business. And what I found out is that the rest of the team kind of had their own team within a team. Mm-hmm. And Bonds and Kent were off on the, you know, island of their separate islands of misfit toys.
So I covered a lot. I wrote a book about Bonds. I always thought two things. Number one, what you just said, he basically was an island to himself. And in a way, the team chemistry in that team was Jason Smith and Rich Aurelia and a million different guys and Reggie Sanders. And Bonds was just kind of an outlier. But number two, if Jason Smith were behaving like Barry Bonds, it wouldn't have worked. It had to be a guy who was just ridiculously good.
Oh, exactly, Jeff. I mean, I really studied this guy. I got fascinated by him, with him, and I was able to spend some time with him and try to see what it looked like through his eyes. But he is the Steve Jobs of baseball. I mean, he is a savant. When it comes to hitting, that guy is a savant. When it comes to reading pitchers, he is a savant. So like a lot of savants, like a Steve Jobs, they're not socially, you know, really tuned in to other people. They don't have a lot of empathy. They don't read faces. They don't really care about what anyone else is doing. Right. And so everybody knew that. And it was just Barry being Barry. And like, he contributed so much to that team's success that you're like, sure, we can do that. Now, if you're not Barry Bonds, you're out of there. You're like, you can't get away with behaving that way. That's why I'm not sure that true, and challenge me on this, Jeff, because you talked to a lot more people than I have. I don't know if there is such a thing as a cancer in a clubhouse, because they would be gone if they're not great. And if they're great and they're helping the team succeed, they can't be a cancer because they're not making the team worse.
I mean, I thought Bonds was, he was a tough one. He was obviously a tough one, and he was very difficult. And if he wasn't a cancer, no one was a cancer. I mean, I wrote the John Rocker story, and John Rocker easily could have been a cancer in Atlanta, but he was quickly marginalized and set aside, and they just cut it out and moved on. The number one thing that causes cancer is someone who brings in a million media members into the clubhouse. And then I think the attitude is, are you fucking kidding me? We had a nice, peaceful existence, and then this guy had to shoot off his mouth. I think that is the number one cause of quote-unquote cancer in a professional sports locker room.
Right. And part of that is kind of the disloyalty. And so it depends on what he's saying. Like, John Rocker wasn't throwing teammates under the bus or talking off the record and then everybody finds out about it. Like, that's really, really disruptive because, again, it erodes the trust. Mm-hmm. And if you just have an idiot like John Rocker just spewing idiotic, awful things, you lose respect for sure. Right. And I also think you lose trust with a guy like that. It's like, Jesus, if he's capable of saying that, you know, and he reflects so poorly.
Right.
The rest of the guys.
Right. You wrote, I thought, a really fascinating chapter called The Arrow Leaf. And it concerned, I got to say, one of my least favorite human beings on social media, Aubrey Huff.
Oh, totally. And I'm with you there, Jeff.
I'm sure you are. And you wrote about Aubrey Huff. I remember him as a young guy with Tampa Bay, and he was a good hitter, but he wasn't that well liked, and he always played for losers. And, you know, you wrote about him, you know, him showing up in the Giant for the Giants, with the Giants, and different guys embracing him and just being like, hey, how's it going? How you doing? Blah, 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 and actually showing interest in him. And suddenly he's beloved. And he's been so awful on Twitter. Awful. And I wonder, because you know, you've worked with the Giants now for a long, did they just not know him? Or does that stuff not really matter in a clubhouse?
I think it matters. But what matters more, I mean, chemistry is secondary, of course, and you got to get the talent. And, you know, believe me, the Giants tried to get somebody else, and it was getting toward the end of the year, early, you know, almost a spring training. And, you know, they pulled him off the scrap heap. You know, nobody wanted him. And, I mean, he was notoriously a terrible teammate. Yeah. And, you know, did the work on the field, but last to the clubhouse, first to leave kind of guy. And totally paranoid about, you know, what people – he expected to be disliked. And so when he showed up in that Giants clubhouse in 2010, and he almost retired because he wasn't getting any phone calls, nobody wanted him, and then the Giants, you know, last minute, come on, one-year contract, come on in. And it was a young team, if you remember. That team, you know, was Bonds' last year was 2008. And so now here we're at 2010. So they'd only had one season without Bonds. So the clubhouse was in transition. And the young guys, the Lincecums, the Matt Cains, the Brian Wilsons, all those guys felt, you know, like the air had been cleared. Because number one, all the media who was, you know, tracking Bonds right up until that last year, you know, they were all gone. So it was a different clubhouse. And I think Huff came in, and they kind of saw him as this veteran. He was charismatic. He was funny in that, you know, clubhouse funny way. It's a very different kind of funny.
Well, you had like him walking with a toothbrush up his ass.
Yes. Right. That kind of thing. And it cracked up all those guys, cracked up those guys. And the young players looked up to him. And when I interviewed Huff, and as you saw in the chapter, no one was more shocked than he was. Right. That the young guys were looking at him for counsel and advice and inspiration. And his best self came out. And it just goes to show, like, how a culture, you know, a trusting, accepting culture can change the people in it and change how they contribute to the team. Because he was never like that before, and he was never like it again. It was that one 2010 team.
Before we continue with Two Riders Singing Yang, a quick word from our sponsor. Hi, this is Jeff Perlman, and I'm live from Casey Perlman's room. And you seem pretty sad.
My clock died.
Damn!
It was a very friendly clock.
What was clock's name?
Just clock. Why would it have a name?
I'll tell you what. Tomorrow, I'll get you a throwback Philadelphia Stars clock from 503 Sports, kings of the throwback sports merchandise. All you gotta do is visit 503sports.com and pick one out.
I don't really want a USFL clock.
That's good, because they don't make them.
It seems like if you have a solid team, adding a wild card or two isn't such a big deal because the team will absorb and you will conform to that. I guess that's always the case, would you say?
Yeah, I mean, if you have a strong culture in that team, and Tony La Russa swears by this, and in fact, you know, he talked one time about, you know, saying that the Cardinals were, you know, talking a little bit about taking on Bonds when, you know, after his last year, after 2008. And Tony La Russa was positive that Bonds would be a different guy, would be a much more teammate type of guy. I mean, you know, well, I do too. I'm not sure that would have been the case. I mean, I think Tony La Russa was, you know, a great manager, and they had good clubhouse leaders in there with Yadier Molina and others. But that's a tough one to turn around. But, you know, people are different at different times in their career, and maybe he might have been ready for that. But I just don't know that he was really capable of it.
Are there certain things you feel like a locker room needs? Like, are there intangibles that are needed to win? Or do you feel like you can win with bad chemistry, you can win with awful chemistry, that talent trumps all?
Well, I don't think that you can just have talent, and because you have to have talent that is driven to win. You know, I mean, you can't just have, okay, this guy is capable of doing this now. Well, is he going to put forth the effort to do it? The other thing is that, you know, a team in which players actually elevate each other's performance, they inspire each other, which again, you know, comes from trust and it comes from having a culture that people can take risks. They're not looking over their shoulder thinking, oh God, if I screw this up, you know, that guy's going to be all over my ass. And then you play tight, you know, your body physiologically responds in a different way. If you're in a clubhouse in which people are judgy, people are complaining about, you know, you're making more money than I am, all of those things that, you know, the talent is going to erode. So you have to have both. And that's where, you know, it's funny how people make this argument about analytics or team chemistry. And it's so puzzling to me. Like, obviously, you know, you got to work at having both. You know, analytics is incredible. You know, it's changed the game, I think, you know, in a good way. I mean, we know so much more about what's actually happening on the field because of analytics. Mm-hmm. And they can come up with, you know, incredibly, you know, brilliant strategies and value their players in a really smart way. But you can have the best strategy in the world. Guess what? It's still actual human beings carrying out your brilliant strategy. So, you know, everything on paper looks terrific, but how do you keep these guys motivated? How do you get them to inspire each other and motivate each other and share what they know with each other? And the military, I mean, I took probably, you know, the best research I came across and really dived into for this team chemistry book was from the military, because no entity knows more about how bonding actually translates into high performance. Because you're out on that battlefield. If those guys aren't bonded, which is why boot camp is so tough, because hardship brings you together. So those guys, every soldier who's been in battle will tell you the same thing. When you're out in the middle of all of that, when you're under almost unbearable stress, they're fighting for each other. And it's no longer God and country. It's for each other. And the same, you know, there's a version of that in sports, that if you get a team that their commitment to purpose becomes the same as commitment to each other, you got a great team chemistry team. Jake Peavy had just the best observation. And I interviewed 150, 160 people, right? And Jake Peavy said something to me that crystallized for me what team chemistry is and what it looks like. And I was talking to Peavy, and you know Peavy, you know, he's the snorter and the stomper on that mound 100% every time he's out there. So I asked him, I said, well, you know, team chemistry obviously lifts the performance of a lot of guys, you know, motivates them. I said, but you're already given 100%, Jake. I mean, you can't give more than 100%. So why do you say team chemistry matters to you? And he said, my teammates bring out a fight in me I can't willingly summon for myself. And I thought, that's it. And then I just needed to figure out, well, how does that happen physiologically and biologically? How does that happen? But that's what team chemistry is.
I always find it weird when you'll hear some player post-game interview talk about we, like the team, right? We, what's the mood in the clubhouse? Well, we, blah, blah, blah. And you're talking about 25 guys in a clubhouse as we. Can you possibly, and I always think like, you don't know, you know, it's the white guy from Arkansas talking and the Dominican second baseman is five stalls over and you've never said three words to him all year. And Japanese pitchers over there with his translator and you nod to him every now and then. And is there actually a such thing as we, a collective, that can apply to the entire team, or is that just something we've kind of created?
Oh, it has to be we. It has to be we, but it may not be the we in the way we expect it to be. You know, every we is different, right?
Right.
You know, what makes up that and what counts as we and connection and bonding and trust. And the one thing I did discover, Jeff, by being on the other side, by being inside the clubhouse and being a media consultant for the Giants now for 13 years, you know, you get to know the players in a different way. You know, the curtain comes back a little bit and you realize how much we don't see. Like we do, and I'll speak for myself. You know, I made so many assumptions about relationships in the clubhouse and relationships among the players and the coaches and who got along and what that was all about. I mean, maybe I knew 10% of what the dynamic actually was in the clubhouse. Because sometimes things look awful from the outside, or they just look like that guy doesn't care about that guy. It's like, no, we don't know. I mean, what happens if they are on an island and this guy, Bennis, I can't remember his first name, but he writes all these business books. Mm-hmm. And he said, you know, great groups are always island communities. They're island groups. They have to be a just us. It has to be about just us. And the Warriors have that, you know, that's their, you know, huddle break cheer before games. And it's just us. And that's what it is. So that's the we. You know, you don't have to like everybody, but you have to be part of that we.
So you're senior media advisor for the Giants. You work with the players, how to sort of deal with the media, interactions with the press. You spent many years as a member of the media, you know, the print media. Are you giving them advice how not to fall for things that you were trying to get them to say in a previous life?
No, actually, you know what I do more than what I've learned to do is to get them to see themselves as the experts, right? I want them to talk to the media. I want them to not give cliches. You know, it's no, you know, the Bull Durham thing. It's like, no. Tell me something I don't know. You know, the media, the fans, everybody wants to hear something. You know, you guys know shit. The rest of us don't know. Tell us how you prepared for that. Give us a sense of the dynamic in the clubhouse and out on the field and in the dugout. You know, I have to give the guys enough respect that, you know, they're adult men. And I say that to them, especially the rookies that come in. It's like, look, or the minor leaguers, you know, yes, you've played a game all your life. And now, you know, you're a businessman as much as you are an athlete. And you got to think like a businessman. You know, you're representing yourself and, you know, this ain't going to last forever. So, you know, you got to lay the groundwork for what's next. And you're representing not just yourself, but your family and your teammates and the community. So, you know, think about what you say before you say it, you know, and if you say it, yes, it's going to get in the newspaper. So don't say it, you know, but don't blame a reporter, you know, who quote made you say something. They can't make you say anything, you know? So it's about being prepared. It's about, you know, using common sense and having fun with it. You know, I just said, you never have to be, there's no reason ever, ever, ever to be an asshole. You know, and if you are, it's nobody's fault but yours.
It seems like assholes are harder to find nowadays as far as dealing with the media. You don't get that many bonds. You don't get that many rockers. You don't get that many. Are they more guarded now than they once were? Do they have less to say than they once were? Are they just, has social media impacted them? Why does it seem like there are fewer asshole moments for athletes now?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, maybe more of them go to college, possibly, than they used to. There's not quite as many, you know, right out of high school signings. And the minor leagues, you know, most of the farm systems are much more hip to all of this now. You know, they, you know, and I do part of this, you know, train them in how to use social media. Of course, they know way more than I do. But, you know, to really be strategic about how you're using social media, and really be strategic about when you're talking to reporters, you know, so there's much more of training that goes into it. And maybe it is a bit more businesslike than it used to be.
Do you find most of the people you deal with, most players you deal with, want to talk to reporters or could completely do without it?
It's a gradual change. The young guys, oh man, I can't get enough of the reporters. You know, they just love it. I mean, they're feeling their oats and, you know, and it's so fun to watch them. It's just like watching a kid toddle across a living room for the first time. You know, like they're just, you know, there's a joy in this discovery of, oh my God, look what my legs can do. That's what these things are here for. you know, I just love watching the kids come in and they go into the dining, you know, the dining room. It's like, oh my God, this is the coolest thing. There's a cappuccino maker in here. Oh, wow. You know, and that's why every club needs to have a rookie. I mean, you just have to have one because they just lift everybody else up.
Right.
But as time goes on, it gets tiresome. And I can see why. You know, because when we're reporters, you know, we're going in and we're only thinking about ourselves. We're not thinking about the, you know, the 20 other people. Not that there's 20 beat reporters on any team now, but it gets old. It really can get old. And the other thing players start to resent is that, you know, they're out in their lockers during media access time, which is shrinking, but they're out in their lockers, you know, and they're answering the questions and they're looking around the clubhouse and it's empty. You know, everybody else in the dining room or in the training room or upstairs, you know, playing ping pong or whatever. And so then they start to resent. They're like, you know, what the hell am I doing out here? You know, I'm not going to sit here and answer questions all day when nobody else is around. So it does weigh on them. And all it takes is one reporter who either misquotes or overplays something. And, you know, that trust is hard to win back.
You're a 23-year-old reporter for whatever, the KNBR website or, you know, whatever, The Athletic.
Yeah.
And you need to do you need 20 minutes with Buster Posey or 15 minutes or whatever. In 2020, how do you approach Buster Posey in the most optimistic and fulfilling way?
Well, the first thing you do is go through channels because that's the first thing Buster will ask. He said, oh, you know, did you talk to Matt, you know, as our senior media relations guy and who does a really good job. So, you know, first of all, you go to the PR guy. Now, if whatever team you're with, you know, is not helping you, you know, you still got to get the interview. So you got to go for it. And, you know, you have to have a sense of what their routine is, right? You know, you can't go up to them, you know, right before BP or go up to them when he's, you know, off doing, you know, maybe he does a training thing in the trainer's room, you know, every single day. So it'd be good to talk to the veteran beat writers, you know, just say, hey, when's the best time to approach Buster Posey? You know, when do you find him usually, you know, in a better frame of mind to answer? And then you have to go up confidently, you know, don't like, you know, sort of slink up, you know, as if you're just going to be, you know, and just say, you know, how are you doing? Here's who I am. Shake his hand like a businessman. And I'm doing a story about this. Do you have time to ask or answer a few questions I have? You know, you just have to be really upfront and direct.
I hate the clubhouse. Has the clubhouse gotten easier over the years or is it the same shit show it's always been?
Oh, well, it's not a shit show. You know what's horrible, Jeff? And this is what I don't miss about it. I mean, I'm so glad I don't have to do it anymore, is the waiting around in the clubhouse for the guy you need to show up.
Yeah, it's bad.
And you look like you're lurking, you know, and the players, I can't tell you how many times I have to tell players why they're there. You know, like, why? They're not doing anything. They're just standing around. You know, why aren't they? I said, yeah, because they're way, you guys are all in the dining room and in the trainer room, you know, if you just come out and talk to them, get, you know, give them what they need and then they'll leave, but they can't leave until they get what they need. So I hated that. I mean, especially as a woman, but I know for every reporter, you know, you're just standing around and, you know, you got those pregame notes and then you got to tweet 17 times. I mean, I wouldn't want to be a beat writer right now. I think it's a tougher job than it's ever been.
I mean, you were certainly a pioneer in sports writing for women. You were the first member of the sports department in Orlando. You definitely took your shit through the years. When you hear women reporters now talk about the difficulties they face, are you more inclined to think you have no idea how bad it was, or can you empathize still with what it is to be a woman walking into a clubhouse as opposed to maybe the more comfort of being a man walking into the same clubhouse?
Oh, I have total empathy for them. And I have empathy for the men too. But for women going in, and it is amazing what the difference is. So those women coming in today, man, they know what they want. You know, that this is the job they want. There's no second guessing, like, God, what was I thinking? Or should I even really be doing this? My dad doesn't even think I should be doing this, that kind of thing. You don't see that anymore. And these women have been wanting to work in sports for their whole life. I mean, I never did. I mean, it never even occurred to me until I got a job at a newspaper. But, you know, they know what they want, and they're so prepared. And they're not cowed by anything. And most, I mean, certainly in San Francisco, but I'm guessing that most baseball teams and football and basketball, I mean, any team, they don't put up with that shit anymore. I mean, they don't want their players at all. I mean, it just doesn't go. It just doesn't go anymore. Like back in my day, you know, the owners were amused by it and thought, well, we're getting exactly what we deserve. So I just think, you know, the clubhouse is still a really intimidating place, but the women who are going in there as reporters now are much more confident and prepared and not easily intimidated as much as certainly I was back in the day.
Don't you think most of these players now, they've just like you were for many of these athletes, you were the first woman they ever saw in a clubhouse. And now the next woman who walks into the Giants clubhouse is going to be the 100th woman they've seen walk into the clubhouse. So they know this is part of the deal, and they're a little more enlightened to this than a guy coming up in the 80s was.
Well, you know, that's what I mean, that's totally true. So I was very surprised a few years ago. I mean, I've been doing this, you know, 13 years. So this was probably 5 years in. And there was, and I was thinking, like, you know, some gal from, you know, graduate school interviewed me, what's it like now compared? I said, you know, now that you mention it, I never hear a player even mention women in the clubhouse, or, you know, it hasn't even been an issue in any way, shape, or form. I said, God, that's amazing. That's really great. Boy, it shows how far we've come. So not too long after that, you know, a player, you know, kind of mid-career, terrific guy, not going to say his name. He said, okay, Joan, well, you know, and press was still in there. And there was something on television, and the guys were watching television. I forget what it was. And he said, so how come women can come into the men's locker room and men can never go in a woman's locker room? Why is that? That doesn't seem fair to me. And I just looked at him and said, like what women's locker room? would the men be going in, right? We don't have a lot of locker rooms. And I said, and guess what? They do go into the WNBA. They do go in there. And he said, well, I mean, what man would want to?
Oh, my God.
And he said, but I can see why women want to come in here. And I said, oh, my God. I said, don't flatter yourself. Do you really think? And he said, well, you know, some of the women, you know, look. I said, is there a woman who comes in to this locker room in San Francisco who has ever given the impression that's why she's in here? Well, no, but there was somebody in, you know, such and such a city. And I said, well, take it up with them. You know, that's a problem. And, you know, in their, you know, in their organization, but, you know, that's just not how it works. And I can't believe that guys still think that. And I thought, well, okay, you know, the battle isn't over, and I do need to address that with the players every year.
I just want to say, it reminds me of, I wrote a Brett Favre biography, and Brett Favre sent pictures of his penis to a reporter.
Oh,
and
I remember.
My number one thought was, what makes you think she wants to see pictures of your penis? You know, like, do you think she's getting these saying, wow, this is my dream has come true. Look at that. This is amazing. Like, the arrogance of the whole thing actually is as disturbing as anything. Like, nobody wants to see her. No one wants to see her junk, buddy. Good news.
No. And in fact, there was another player, and we were just kind of like, I forget how it came up, but a similar kind of question. And it was a player I know very well. And I just started laughing. I said, I got to tell you, you know, and I'm old enough to be all their mothers, maybe grandmother at this point. But I said, you guys so overestimate the attractiveness of that body part.
Right, exactly.
Nobody's coming in here to say, wow, now that's a good looking one.
Bizarre. It's really bizarre.
And he just laughed. He laughed, really? I said, oh, God. I said, you guys got to get over yourselves there.
Yeah, well, I appreciate you coming on. I really do. And I hope this book sells a million copies and becomes the next Moneyball.
I do too, Jeff. And whatever you can do to make that happen would be greatly appreciated.
I want to thank today's guest, Joan Ryan, for joining me on Two Writers Singing Yank. You can follow Joan on Twitter at Joan Ryan and visit her website, joanryaninc.com. Her new book, Intangible, Unlocking the Science and Soul of Team Chemistry, is available everywhere. One can listen to Two Writers Singing Yank on pretty much every podcast medium, and reviews are always appreciated. Music is by the dazzling MC White Owl. Thanks again for joining me. Remember, keep writing.